One of my favorite writers is Todd Wilson. He puts out what is probably the best email letter to fathers that I know of. And he's written a book entitled Reflections of a Father's Heart, in which he tells the following story. He says, I love the Olympics. I love the excitement that hangs in the air as athletes from all over the globe gather to test their abilities against each other while couch potatoes across the country assume their positions in front of the TV to watch. Like most Americans, I have an Olympic moment that will be etched forever in my memory. Unlike most Americans, though, it has little to do with an actual event. I'm not even sure what event it was, except there was snow and the woman had on skis. I'm pretty sure it wasn't downhill skiing because there's no mountain in this memory. The Olympian's name is unknown, and maybe that's best, but the words she said over the airwaves will never be forgotten by this dad. What made it all the more poignant was that it was preceded by a little docudrama of the Olympian's life. The cameras took us to her home and gave us a glimpse of her routine and typical workout. Playing to the audience, they showed us the woman's young son, who looked no older than 3 at the time. He was blonde-headed and had all the energy of a toddler. He giggled, laughed, and melted the hearts of the viewers. Oddly, he was most often seen with an unidentified woman who cared for him, while his mom was training for the gold. And train she did. Her face was hardened by the cold wind and sun from years of being outside. Her muscles were tight, and the resolve of a champion was heard in her voice and seen in her eyes. She wanted more than anything in the world to win a gold at that Winter Olympics. She sacrificed everything for that goal, including the privilege and joy of raising her son. As the music softened and the interview came to an end, the Olympian sadly admitted, I'm probably the worst mother in the world. And with that, the docudrama ended, and we found ourselves back at the live coverage of the event she was about to race. A few words of color commentary, and the racers were called to take their marks. Sunglasses covered her eyes, and her jaws tightened for the race of her life. This was the moment for which she had trained and sacrificed. It would be worth it. The crowd was still, and for a brief moment, my muscles tensed in anticipation of the start. Bang! The gun sounded and was immediately followed by a second shot. I want to speak to you this morning on the subject, the 3 key elements of successful parenting. Now, the book of Proverbs has many general statements of truth. This doesn't mean that every verse is totally inflexible with no exceptions. One of those statements is Proverbs 16:7. When a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. Then there is a powerful statement that relates to child training in Proverbs 22:6. Would you read it with me all together, please? Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. That general truth has a profound implication that goes with it. If a child chooses evil as an adult, his parents probably failed in some way to properly train him. Now, I don't think that that verse is saying there will be no exceptions. The bottom line of everything is personal responsibility, but the exceptions will be the exception, not the rule. And wise parents should be humble to understand where they may have failed so as to be able to help others. In my observation, 95 to 99% of the rebellion in Christian young people is caused or at least affected by the anger or inconsistency in one or both of the parents. Perhaps the most important single verse in the Bible in relation to parenting is Ephesians 6:4. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Another key passage in relation to parenting is Deuteronomy 6:6-7. Listen to it. And these words, which I command thee this day, shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. Notice, thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children. Now, there's so many things that can be said about parenting that they couldn't be covered in one day, much less in 1 hour. Who could guess how many books have been written on the subject or how many sermons have been given on the subject? But I believe there are 3 key elements in successful parenting. that if you get them in your mind and heart and then carry them out in your daily life, you may truly expect to produce wise, godly children. The problem is these elements tend to pull against each other. I want to give you these three key elements up front and then spend the rest of my time explaining and breaking them down for you. Here they are in an ABC format. Number one, always win. Firmness is necessary. The parent must be the parent. Number two, be gentle. You must ask God to cleanse your life from harshness and anger. And number three, consistently be consistent. The parent must be consistent and predictable rather than inconsistent and unpredictable. There they are. Always win, be gentle, and consistently be consistent. Would you say those with me all together, please, everyone? Always win, be gentle, consistently be consistent. Now, let me break those down for you. Number one is always win in training the child to obey. Proverbs 22:6 did not read like this. Children, train your parents in the way you want them to go so that when you're older, both you and your parents can be miserable. Proverbs 22:6 is a command to the parents. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. In other words, the parent, not the child, must be the winner, or must at least be perceived by the child to be the winner in every contest of wills between the parent and the child. Colossians 3:20 says, children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. That phrase, well-pleasing unto the Lord, only occurs that one time in the entire Bible in relation to the family. Children, God is well-pleased when you obey your parents. And parents, it's like God is specifically watching your family to see if you will make your children obey your commands. When you tell your child, no, don't touch that, and the child deliberately disobeys you, and you don't let the child get by with his disobedience, God looks down from heaven and says, that parent's making him obey. I like that. I'm pleased with that. And when God sees you letting your child get by with disobedience, God says, don't do that. I gave you that child to train for me. If he or she doesn't know how to obey you, then he's not going to know how to obey me. And that can be disastrous. After every encounter with the child, a parent should ask himself or herself this question, did I win? Or did the child win? If the parent wins, everybody wins. And if the parent loses, everyone loses. A key to your children being winners in life is for you to always win in disciplining them as they are growing up. A good phrase to use over and over at your house might be this, do what I say right away, with a smile. Say that with me, would you please? Do what I say right away with a smile. Now, you got to understand, it has nothing to do with how big the command is. God's command to Adam and Eve to not eat the fruit may not look to you like a big command, but their disobedience plunged them and the whole human race into sin. If it is serious enough for you to tell a child to do something, it is also serious enough for you to follow through and make sure that he does it. The issue is not how big or small the command is. The issue is simply authority. The parent must be the parent. The child must not become the parent. An agent went to a certain house to sell his wares. He rang the doorbell. A woman came to the door. And he said to her, I'd like to see the head of the house. She said, well, sit down there on the corner of the porch and wait. The baby isn't awake yet. That's a humorous story. But disobedience to authority is not humorous, folks. Disobedience is far more serious than many parents realize. The first time the word disobedient occurs in the Bible, it is associated with death. In 1 Kings 13:26, we're told that the unnamed man of God was disobedient unto the word of the Lord. And God sent a lion that killed him and then simply stood next to his dead body. What had the man done that was so serious? He had simply eaten bread and drunk water with an old prophet. But God had told him not to eat bread or drink water with anyone. It wasn't the meal, it was the disobedience. Incidentally, 1 Kings 13, that chapter I just referred to, is a great chapter to read to teach children the importance of first-time obedience. And while you're studying that chapter, don't miss that the Hebrew word translated disobeyed and disobedient there is usually translated rebel. What is a teenage rebel? He is often the product of a child who was not made to obey. The parent must always win because God made the parent the parent. Now let me clarify this. When I say win, I don't mean there won't ever be a time when the parent realizes that he or she is wrong and apologizes then to the child. But that should be the exception, not the rule. I don't mean there won't ever be a time when a child is given mercy because of obvious brokenness and repentance instead of chastisement. But if a child displays disobedience or rebellion or willfulness, and the parent backs down from the child, then that foolishness that Proverbs 22:15 says is bound in the heart of a child becomes bound even more tightly. When a parent loses, the child's own carnal nature wins. And worse than that, the child learns that he can win. Someone wrote this to an advice columnist. My brother's family lives in another town. They visited us several times in the past, staying 3 or 4 days each time. Every visit has been a disaster because they don't discipline their 2 young children. Last time they were here, the children scratched our wood floors, loosened our oak stairway railing by hanging on it, and ran and jumped around endlessly. When I tried to control the youngest daughter, she blatantly told me she can do whatever she wants. And she is only 4 years old. The family keeps trying to corner us to visit again. How should we handle this? Now, what's happened in that family? That 4-year-old has found out that she can win. And she is. And she will continue to win as long as her parents allow her to do so. How much easier it would have been on the child, the parents, and everyone else if the child had had parents who had won the first showdown with the child and then had determined they would win all subsequent showdowns. What would parents like that have to do, those parents of that wild 4-year-old? They would have to reach a point where they draw the line. Sit down and look the child in the eyes and talk to her. Explain to her what was going to happen for the next disobedience. And then, a few minutes later probably, firmly, lovingly, and consistently keep their word. A godly mother told how she had turned her strong-willed firstborn 1-year-old son's determination in the right direction. He was determined to empty the kitchen cabinets so he could play with the pots and pans. She was determined he wasn't going to, and she was determined she was going to win. She got down on her hands and knees and made eye contact with him. Get this now. Until you make eye contact with a child, you will probably not truly communicate with the child. A key goal of parenting is to guide your child with your eyes. When the parent is not looking at the child, he's not really communicating. Psalm 32:8 says, I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way which thou shalt go. I will guide thee with mine eye. The goal of parenting is to guide your child with your eyes. Many parents repeat themselves over and over, because they don't get and hold the eyes of their children. When that one-year-old started emptying the cabinet, his mother firmly, gently said no, frowned and shook her head and lightly swatted his little hand. He went for it again. And again she said no, and frowned and shook her head and lightly swatted his little hand. And again and again she said, for that strong will, firstborn, one-year-old son, it lasted an hour. But she won. Then he crawled away to happily play with his toys. And I'm going to tell you something, in the long run, that mother not only saved herself a lot of time, she also taught her son one of life's most important lessons anyone can ever learn, and that is this: authority wins. What is God's main way to get the foolishness out of a child? The rest of Proverbs chapter 22, verse 15 says, the first part said, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child. The second part says, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. There must be some means of external control for a child until he is helped to develop his own set of internal controls. A loving spanking with a small rod is God's way to teach a child one of life's most important lessons: disobedience brings pain. Never shake a child. Never grab a child. Never beat a child. Never strike or hit a child in anger. You spank a child in anger, you accomplish absolutely nothing. In fact, you make it worse. Proverbs 22:8 says, the rod of anger shall fail. And that word, in other places in the Hebrew, that word fail means it will destroy. It will destroy him. It will not help him. It will destroy him. I had a fellow who said to me one time, several months ago, I was talking to him on the phone in another state. He said, I disagree with one of your messages. I said, what's that? I said, well, I'm certainly able to make mistakes, and I certainly want to learn. Tell me what it is. He said, if parents don't discipline their children in anger sometime, then they may not discipline them at all. I said, I'm sorry, but I give you Bible. The Bible says the rod of anger shall fail. Now you give me your opinion. I want Bible to back up what you said. He just got angry and went on and changed the subject. Love your child enough to chasten him. Proverbs 13:24 says, he that spareth his rod hateth his son. But he that loveth him chasteneth him betimes. You lovingly counter disobedience with a brief, measured level of pain. Richard Fugate, in his outstanding book, What the Bible Says About Child Training, said this. Listen to it. The object of chastisement is not to beat a child into submission by the use of brute force. The use of an instrument that can cause more than surface pain can actually hurt the child, which causes the parent to resent his lack of control and perhaps cease chastising altogether because of his feeling of guilt. Often when a paddle, a board, or a belt is used, it becomes a challenge to a male youth to prove his manhood by enduring the maximum force. Using a rod eliminates this problem. There's no pride in bearing up to a narrow rod, and it can certainly not cause any lasting injury. The pain received from a rod is more humbling than harmful. There's no defense against it. The more a child braces himself, the more he tightens up and increases the sting. The most sensitive layer of skin is close to the surface where the nerve endings are located. The only way to stop the sting of a rod is to submit. That is exactly what a child will do: submit to his parents' will and thus end his rebellion. Notice that the Bible word is correction or chastening. The word is not usually punishment. The goal is change or reformation. A grown man told me about his relationship coming up with his father. He said this: he never ever spanked us in anger. He had a way of dealing with us that touched us at the deepest level of our emotions. His motive was always right. His manner was always right. We all love Dad for the way he dealt with us. One of the things a parent ought to do when they spank a child is explain that since God loves us, he chastens us. Now, Johnny, you understand, since I love you, I have to spank you. Over-permissiveness builds rejection and resentment in a child. You don't love them enough to make them do right. One of the questions I've been asked repeatedly over the last several years, I want to answer this morning. What about time out or standing in the corner? Now, I'm not against those things, but biblically speaking, that tends to be a harsher punishment than a loving spanking. When Cain was sent out from the presence of the Lord, his response in Genesis 4:13 was, "My punishment is greater than I can bear." My suggestion to parents is that you use time out for really big problems. If you have a child who lies, give him 30 minutes looking at a clock in the corner with nothing else he can do. The next time he lies, double the time. After that, add an hour or double the time every time. Give water, give potty breaks, and give nothing else. If he goes to sleep, deduct sleep time from the time spent. Almost any child would choose a spanking over what I just described. Now, I don't mean to be critical here, but nowhere in the Bible that I know of do you find that drugs is the way to control disobedient children. What you do find, in fact, that's a new phenomenon in history that's only been taking place for a few years now. And suddenly we're drugging so many children. We better wake up and realize, I wouldn't say that that should never ever happen, but I will tell you this, it would be extremely rare. What did people do all those decades and centuries and millennia of time with disobedient children when they didn't have those drugs to deal with them? They spanked them, or if necessary, they made them sit. And the reason sitting in the corner or whatever you want to call it is an extreme punishment is because they're literally losing life. Life is just passing by. There's nothing more dull than just losing time out of your life. In some ways, that is more punishment than it is chastisement or correction. The key thing is always the parent must win. If you spank a child and he is still looking rebellious, you're not done with the spanking. If you set the child, I was in a home the other day, and a little child came in and was just going absolutely berserk. And the parent said, "Now, all right, we're going to have to do a timeout." The parent said, walked over and took the child to the timeout spot and said, "Now you stay there 10 minutes. And by the time the parent got sat back down on the couch, the child was already in the living room again. Do you see what the problem is? The problem is there is no discipline. The problem is the child keeps winning. And a child left to himself will bring his mother to shame. Now what you find in the Bible is a key principle, and that principle is this. Listen to this. When the displeasure that parents bring into the child's life for disobedience is stronger than the pleasure that comes from the disobedience, the disobedience is going to stop. Until the parent reaches the point where they are creating more displeasure for disobedience than the child is getting pleasure out of his disobedience, until you reach that point, that disobedience is just going to continue on. You've got to win the battle. Why do parents lose battles in public? Because they lose them in private. Last Sunday morning, I could not get back from the state of Washington, and so a pastor out in that area asked me to preach. Good pastor, good father. I walked in on Sunday morning service, and I sat down on the front row of the church, and looked right behind me on the second row, and there were five of the pastor's seven children, including three little boys, sitting attentively and respectfully right behind me on the second row. Mom was in the choir. Dad was on the platform. And those three little boys, I'm guessing they were 6, 5, and 3, were as well behaved as any adult in the auditorium or any other person in the auditorium. Now, I want to tell you something, that didn't happen by chance. In fact, Pastor Houston said to me, "Brother Davis, I've been gone from home too much for the last couple of weeks, and the control of the children is beginning to slip a little bit, but I'll be back at home more this week and we'll get it back." You know what he was saying? He was saying, we've learned how to win. And Mom wins from the choir loft, and Dad wins from the front row of the church with three little boys sitting side by side on the front row, because they know Dad and Mom always win. Dad and Mom win at home in private. That means they can win in public. If you have a child who extremely goes wild in a grocery store somewhere like that, it usually means he's gone wild and gotten by with it at home. Now, if you have a child that obeys you at home but disobeys you in public, there is a simple solution to that. Remember, you've got to win. You can't let the child get by. I told a story in another message a while back by a little boy that was standing at the checkout lane, and his pregnant mother was standing right there next to him, and he's screaming and hollering for a chocolate candy bar. She says, "No, you can't have it." He screams and hollers again. "No, you can't have it." And with that, he hauled off with his little fist and hit Mama right in the belly. Mama gave him the candy bar. Reached over, picked it up, and said, "Oh, all right, here, you can have it." I want to tell you, not only is that boy developing a taste for chocolate, he is developing a taste for rebellion and disobedience and willfulness and anarchy. He's learning that if he can just do any, he can just get mad enough and scream hard enough. Now, what does a parent have to do? They're going through the grocery store. They win the battles at home. And they're going through the grocery store, and a little child decides they're going to throw a fit. Parents should get the child's eyes very calmly, look the child in the eyes and say, "You can either stop this right now, or we will go home and take care of it, and then we will come back." Now, if the child knows you mean that, that child will probably obey. But if the child's not sure, he may test you once or twice. He may throw a fit right there in public. "No!" Best thing you can do at that point is leave the groceries in the cart. Head out the door. Drive home or some quiet, safe, secure, non-public place. Purpose of chastisement is not to embarrass a child. And take care of the disobedience, however long it takes you. Get the child's eyes very calmly. Spank the child. Or if you need, if you feel like that won't do it and you need to take an hour and all he can do is sit and look at the clock and you sit and look at him, okay, however long it takes. The big thing is this. He's got to know you're going to win. Then you can go back to the store. You say, "What if he does it again?" Then take him home again. The parent must win. Are you getting this point? What's the first point? Say it. Always win. You've got to always win. One of the things I've noticed that keeps parents from always winning is allowing children to make excuses for what they do wrong. A child doesn't have to be taught how to manipulate his parents. His fallen nature can figure that out without any help at all. While Moses was on Mount Sinai receiving the Ten Commandments, the people asked Aaron down in the valley below to make them a visible god. They brought their gold, and Aaron made them a golden calf. Moses' question to Aaron was really an invitation for Aaron to blame the people instead of taking personal responsibility. Be careful that you don't ask a child a question that allows him or encourages him to blame others. Exodus 32:21 reads, "And Moses said unto Aaron, What did this people unto thee, that thou hast brought so great a sin upon them?" Do you see what he's saying? What did they do to you? The issue is not what they did Aaron. The issue is what did Aaron do? In the next verse, Aaron immediately blamed the people. Then he blamed Moses for being gone so long. Then Aaron blamed the gold itself. In one of the most ridiculous statements any man ever made, Aaron said this, "I cast the gold into the fire and there came out this calf." Duh. "I threw the gold in and this calf jumped out. This golden calf, it just came out. I didn't really have anything." You see, if you're going to make excuses, any excuse will work. And if you're going to take excuses, parents, any excuse will do. People will make excuses if you let them. Children will always have some excuse or will gladly blame somebody else. You don't have to teach them to do that. They will figure it out themselves. There are really only two questions that really matter. You might want to write these down. What did you do? Did you know it was wrong? What did you do? Did you know it was wrong? If a child who has done wrong gets off by blaming someone else, the child has won, the parent has lost, and the child's training breaks apart. When children lose and parents win, the children are really the winners. A disciplined child is a happier, safer child. I read a report several years ago where a doctor said, it is much safer for a child who is sick and disciplined than it is for a child who comes in who is sick and undisciplined, because you can't hardly treat an undisciplined sick child. Sometimes they have to do all kinds of things just to treat an undisciplined sick child. Listen to this. A visitor was chatting with a missionary in Brazil, and while they sat on the front porch, the missionary's child was playing in the lawn. Suddenly, the missionary shouted to his child, "Johnny, lie down on the ground." The child obeyed immediately. "Crawl toward me as fast as you can." Obedience was instant. The next command came, "Now get up and run toward me as fast as you can." The visitor was wondering if he was getting some bizarre exhibition of sadistic child control. When the child reached the father's arms, a large poisonous snake dropped down from a tree onto the grass where the child had been playing. What if that father had not taught his child instant obedience? The child could have been dead. A disciplined child is also a happier child. Ray Wingers told this story. He said, our friends had a 10-year-old son who knew the security and contentment resulting from healthy discipline in the home. His mother, the mother of the 10-year-old, made him responsible to watch the 3-year-old child of a friend, a child who continually misbehaved and exhibited unwholesome attitudes. The boy discussed the problem with his mother afterward and explained, "That child is an unhappy kid. What he needs is discipline. Discipline is the key to happiness." This is a 10-year-old. "Discipline is the key to happiness." Then with horror on his face, he realized what his statements needed to be applied to himself. And he said, "Oh, what am I saying?" The one most important principle is to never allow a child's rebellion to be successful. Always win the contest. You can do this because of your position as banker, cook, house cleaner, playtime supervisor, provider, work detail manager, etc. Stand your ground. If you develop a reputation as a winner of conflicts, you will be home free. If you develop a reputation as a vacillating wimp that whines and complains about how you're treated, they will run over you like a discarded aluminum can. The key is to win. Always win. Stand by your demands. Be just. Be reasonable. Be consistent. Be tough. Be there all the time, ever in his face, loving, laughing, smiling, and demanding compliance as the foreman of the home. That was from Michael Pearl. What is the key thing you must ask after every encounter with a child? Did you win or did the child win? If the parent wins, you both win. And if the parent loses, you both lose. Remember the phrase, do what I say right away with a smile. As far as responsibilities go, The number one responsibility a parent has is to teach a child to obey the first time, every time. It is more important than teaching math. It's more important than teaching science. It's more important than teaching to learn to read. If he doesn't learn authority and obedience and respect for authority, his life cannot move forward like God wants it to. As far as relationships go, the number one thing a parent must do is get and keep their children's hearts. What does God seek from us more than anything else? Our hearts. Romans 10:9, that if thou shalt confess with thy mouth the Lord Jesus, shalt believe in thine heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. What's it saying? It's saying God wants your heart. Am I talking to somebody here this morning? And you think you're going to get to heaven by simply doing some works of obedience? It won't happen. You've got to trust Jesus as your Savior. You've got to give God your heart. I want to tell you something else. You will not have heaven in your home if you're simply... Is everybody listening? Say amen. You will not have heaven in your home if you're simply a drill sergeant shouting demands. Because the heart is delicate is the second key point. First was always win. The second is, say it with me, be gentle. You must. Because the heart is delicate, you must be gentle. A parent is always examining his child's heart. But to do so, he's got to use his heart. Out of the heart are the issues of life. How would you like to have a rough, gruff heart surgeon? But what are you dealing with when you're dealing with a child? You're dealing with his heart. You've got to be gentle. You notice how these tend to pull against each other? Firmness must be balanced with gentleness, or it quickly becomes harshness. You've got to have them both. You've got to have firmness, and you've got to have gentleness. What tends to happen with parents is this. They'll pull one way. They'll say, boy, I'm not firm enough. They'll start pulling that way. Then they become harsh. They'll say, no, I got to become gentle. They'll start pulling that way, and then they're no longer firm. How difficult it is to balance those two. They're like opposites that pull against each other. But successful parenting involves both firmness and gentleness at the same time. In 2 Corinthians 10:1, Paul referred to the meekness and gentleness of Christ. I doubt if there are any of us who really comprehend how gentle Jesus was. In Psalm 18:35, here's one of my favorite verses in the whole Bible. I suggest you memorize it. David said about God, thy gentleness hath made me great. Greatness in a child is produced by gentleness in his parents. I give you my observation after over 50 years of living and almost 30 years of pastoring, that the most truly successful parents are firm but very gentle people. Especially have I noticed the impact on children's lives who have a father who is a gentle man, who deals delicately, kindly, lovingly, tenderly, and gently with his children. When I was in Louisiana a few months ago, a man told me a remembrance of when he was an 8-year-old boy sitting at the table with his mother eating breakfast. His mother finished eating, handed the boy the china plate and silverware with her leftover breakfast on it, and told the boy to dump it in the trash. The 8-year-old boy, thinking he was obeying, walked over to the trash can and dumped the whole plate, the silverware, and everything in the plate in the trash can. The next thing he knew, his mother had gotten up and hit him on the back of the head and said, "You stupid idiot, what are you doing?" The boy then looked up at his mother and replied, "But you told me to throw it away in the trash." Honestly, not understanding. He told me as an adult man in his 40s, he said, "I honestly did not understand that what I did was wrong." Now, what's that mother's problem? Jerking that kid around, slapping him around, screaming at him. It's a lack of gentleness. Tertullian said this, "It is better to keep children to their duty by a sense of honor and by kindness than by fear and punishment." While trying to win in training your child, you must also win over your own angry nature. harsh, angry parenting is the number one cause of rebellion in young people in our day. Watch me. Here's how it happens. The parent expresses anger at the child in violation of Ephesians 6:4. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. He breaks the negative command. That is the most serious command in the Bible to parents, because it's the only negative one that I know, and it is repeated almost word for word in Colossians as well. God gives it twice. We better wake up and recognize that command is powerful. Because nothing provokes to wrath like wrath, the child also becomes angry at the parent. But the child is not allowed to express his anger at the parent. So he internalizes his anger, which turns into bitterness. That bitterness then explodes as outward rebellion in the middle of the teen years. We hear about it over and over and over again. Last Monday evening, we were at the St. Louis airport, waiting on a flight to Springfield, Illinois. We're sitting in one of the little restaurants there, and we watched this happen. A father, a mother, a son, and a daughter. The boy was 9 or 10 years of age. The girl, 7 or 8 years of age. And the father upset at the boy about something, I mean, screamed at him and used the filthiest word in the English language, blank you, to a 9 or 10 year old boy. Then upset with the daughter, reached over, grabbed the daughter by the chin and squeezed real hard like this and said something. That father better brace himself real fast for rebellion in those children. They did not rebel on the spot. There was nothing but fear, horrible fear in their eyes. But his anger was producing anger in those children, which will turn into bitterness, which given time is almost guaranteed to turn into rebellion. The great missionary of the 1800s, John Patton, missionary to the New Hebrides Islands, which is currently Vanuatu. In his autobiography, tremendous autobiography, I highly recommend that you ought to read it. He said this, God help the homes where things are done by force and not by love. The very discipline through which our father passed us was a kind of religion in itself. If anything really serious required to be punished, he retired first to his closet for prayer. And we boys got to understand that he was laying the whole matter before God. And that was the severest part of the punishment for me to bear. I could have defied any amount of mere penalty, but this spoke to my conscience as a message from God. We loved Dad all the more when we saw how much it cost him to discipline us. And in truth, we had never very much of that kind of work. He had never very much of that kind of work to do upon any one of all 11 of us. We were ruled by love far more than by fear. You know what the opposite of a spirit of anger is? It's found in Romans 8:15. It's the spirit of adoption. I love that verse. Ye have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear, but ye have received the spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, Father. Every family needs a spirit of adoption, whether the children are adopted or not. What is it? That is a happy spirit that wants children and enjoys spending time with children. A spirit of adoption is far more likely to produce a spirit of obedience than will a spirit of anger. Children are not old beat-up trucks that you can kick and make them run better. I remember an old 1967 truck that a worker had left parked in my driveway overnight, and late at night, the horn on the thing started beeping. Beep! And we went out there trying to find it, and finally figured out what it was, that it was that old truck parked 150 feet down the driveway. And I went out there to try to figure out what to do. And you know what I found out? I stepped up on the old running board and it stopped. I stepped off and it started again. I tried kicking it a time or two. It'd break up, you know, and I'd stand on it and it would stop, and I'd step off of it and it'd start again. I will tell you, your children are not an old truck for you to kick around. Every family needs that spirit of adoption. A child is not an old truck. He's a piece of fine china to be handled firmly but gently. Proverbs 29:21. Everybody here ought to study this verse. Turn and look at it if you want to. It is a powerful verse in this area. Listen to it. He that delicately bringeth up his servant from a child shall have him become his son at the length. That verse is saying that a master who treats his servant kindly and gently will cause his servant to become his son. That gentleness builds the relationship that turns a servant into a son. Do you see the spirit of adoption there? Do you realize there are adopted children who are closer to their parents than many naturally born children are? We have some here in our church. You know why? One word, gentleness. It is dealing with a child delicately that truly makes the child your child. Brother Winfred Baker, a pastor in Covington, Louisiana, said to me when I was in Louisiana, Brother Davis, I remember the last whipping I got. I was about 14 and my older brother and I were in the corn crib. We were supposed to be shucking corn. Instead, we started arguing. Then we started physically fighting. Our dad heard us and called us out of the corn crib. Before he spanked us, he sat down and talked to us. And while he was talking, he started crying. He said, "Boys, I feel bad that I've raised boys who fight with each other when they're supposed to love each other." Brother Baker said to me, "Brother Davis, I barely remember the spanking, but I've never forgotten my dad's tears." And I decided then and there I would not do anything to break my dad's heart again. You see what he's doing? He's ruling with a rod of love. He's ruling with a rod of tenderness and care. There is a power that is incredible to kindness and gentleness. I picked up an old book from the 1800s. And I was thumbing through the book and I saw a poem entitled, "The Good for Nothing Little Boy." Now, I don't believe there is such a thing as a good for nothing boy, but this poem makes a powerful point. Listen to it carefully. He really was, without a doubt, a good for nothing boy. He never wiped his boots at home. He broke his sister's toy. When mother's head was aching and her face was pale with care, he banged the door when he went out and had no thought for her. He was always quick to quarrel. He was never known to smile. And for the temper that he had, the only word was vile. His brothers and sisters all just left him to his ways. He was a good-for-nothing boy whom none could love or praise. When he went off to school each day, things were no better there. His master said his ways perverse, no flesh and blood could bear. When all the class was busy, he coolly sauntered in. And though he oft was punished, yet he didn't care a pin. And worst of all, the other boys began to learn his ways. They made the master angry where they once had earned his praise. And though he had a patient soul, he suffered much annoy. And all because of this one little good-for-nothing boy. Then someone came along one day whose name was Kindly Heart. And he spoke to Good for Nothing with love's endearing art. He pointed out the only way in which all this must end, and tried in kind and gentle ways to help him and befriend, till Good for Nothing quite broke down and then began to cry and said, "To be a better boy, I'll really try." And so he gave a promise that he would mend his ways and cause his friends to love him and strive to earn their praise. And then somehow there seemed to come a wondrous change in him. And those who used to know him said it seemed just like a dream. At home, his ways were altered. He gentle grew and kind. And for the good of others, he learned to have a mind. Once when his sister's dolly fell down and broke her head, he didn't make the mischief worse, but mended it instead. At school he learned his lessons, his time he'd well employ, till everybody finally said, "Oh, what a good for something little boy." What an interesting poem. Again, I say, I don't believe there is such a thing as a good for nothing little boy, but the poem makes a point. There is a power in gentleness and kindness that you cannot find in harshness. Number one, what was it? Say it with me. Always win. Number two, be gentle. And number three, consistently be consistent. Remember Ephesians 6:4. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture an admonition of the Lord. And to bring them up there is a present active imperative in the Greek. It means this. You bring them up and you keep doing this. You keep doing this. You cannot start doing what you need to do and then stop. Continuous, consistent action is needed. Parents must be unbending in the clear-cut areas of right and wrong. Could I take a strong piece of steel and stand here and bend it? No. Neither should a child be able to bend truthfulness. A child must not be able to bend honesty, to bend respectfulness, to bend obedience, or to bend kindness. There must be consistency. It will not happen. Dad and Mom, hear me, Dad and Mom, you must stand together. And children must know that it is not possible to pit Mom against Dad or Dad against Mom. Too many dads and moms act like two instead of one. You remember when you got married? God made you one. One of Jacob and Esau's problems was they had a dad saying one thing and a mom saying something else. A 15-year-old young man, while walking home, was attacked by a gang. The gang was carrying out an initiation which required them to kill somebody. They beat the boy mercilessly, kicking him in the face, head, and neck. Miraculously, he was able to flee to his house before he collapsed. But there's an interesting side note to that story. The boy had asked his father if he could go to a certain place, even though his father had previously said no, and the father again said no, and the boy went and asked his mother, who said, "Oh, your father's being too strict," and let the boy go. And that boy for life will have scars to remind him on his face of the importance of obedience. And the mother will have to see those scars to remind her not to undermine the father. I know a family where the mother let the children put on immodest clothes while the father was at work. "Mom, back up Dad. Dad, back up Mom." You must be one voice with the children. Have consistency in your doctrine, in your beliefs, in your church attendance, in the Bible that you use, in the standards that you hold in relation to music and dress and friends and so on. Consistently be consistent. Growth and change is fine. Inconsistency and unpredictability is not fine. Some dads will say something today, then change it tomorrow. Then go back the next day, then change to something different the next day. That drives children crazy. What if your boss changed like that? Some parents will hear a sermon like this and change for a few days. Then they go back to letting the children win, or they go back to becoming angry and harsh. Be at least as consistent in training your children as you are in working at your job. Those three fellows, come on up here, and one of you grab that hoop and come over here, would you please? The time, hear this statement. The time you spend as a parent is more important as a part of your life, work, and mission than whatever you might do that produces a family income. You must be committed long range to doing what you need to do as a parent. Ray Wenger said, "Discipline is hard work, requiring diligence, persistence, consistency, and sacrifice." Sometimes when parents realize the failure of their past, they resolve to operate their homes in a biblical manner. Then they're shocked when several sound spankings do not result in immediate transformation of their child's character. They've expected the wall of Jericho to fall after circling the city once or twice. Model children are not available as instant results of stirring in magic ingredients. Model children are available when parents consistently obey God's directives in discipline and therefore open the channel for God's grace to be poured upon their family. I point out to you that one reason it's hard to be consistent is because each of these three points are pulling against each other. Come here, fellas, if you will. I got to stay near this microphone. Okay? Now, let me point this out to you. Grab that. Okay? Now. Here. Okay, go that way and pull that way a little bit, if you will, brother. Okay, pull that way a little more. Step on. There you go. Now, here are the three points. What are they? Say the first one. Always win. Be gentle. Consistently be consistent. Now the hoop must be pulled tightly. Don't break it, but pull it. It must be pulled tightly. And the difficulty of balancing the first two makes you want to give up on the third one. The difficulty of balancing the first one, always win and be gentle. And so this, you want to always win, and so you pull that way and you lose gentleness. And then you want to be gentle, so then you lose your firmness. And the difficulty of balancing those two causes you to fail to be consistent. It's got to stay right there with a tight hold on all three at once. You must pull tightly all the time on all three, always winning, always being gentle, and always being consistent. Thank you, fellas. I appreciate it. Firmness, gentleness, and consistency. The lady who had been interviewed before she ran down the ski slope in the Olympics had told somebody that she was probably the worst mother in the world. Then she lined up. The racers were all about to take their march. Sunglasses had covered her eyes. Her jaws tightened for the race of life. The crowd was silent. Bang! The gun sounded and was immediately followed by a second shot. The racers pulled up short, and to the amazement of everyone, the woman who had been the focus of the interview and docudrama had been disqualified because of a false start. The race was over. So was her dream. The commentators lamented the fate of this Olympian. Moments later, the viewers were whisked away to another event, another Olympian, another docudrama, and that was the last I saw of her. What I remember is the feeling I had as the coverage continued. I thought then, as I have on many occasions, how sad and how dumb. She actually believed the sacrifices she made as a parent would be worth a big shiny bottle cap on a string, which she never got. Even if she had won the gold, I wonder if she would have found the sacrifices worth it, or would more than its finish have tarnished. There were three losers that day: an Olympian, a little blonde-headed boy, and a mother. She was trading diamonds for stones. It's not just about Olympians and athletes. It's about plumbers and electricians and engineers and accountants and farmers and truck drivers and school teachers and pastors, plain, ordinary people who have been duped into trading diamonds for big, shiny bottle caps on strings. They're willing to make sacrifices, even if it might be their families. And if they're fortunate enough to reach the goal, the world stands to its feet, because that's what we do. We applaud the best, the successful, but there's little applause for dad and moms who give up success and position to raise the children God has given them. That's okay. When no one claps and no one notices, set your jaw and refuse to give up. Keep going, because you know it'll be worth it. There will come a day when your children will grow up and leave. They will rise up and call you blessed. The phone will ring and a mature voice will say, "I just need to get your opinion." You'll grow old knowing that you ran the race. You trained, taught, loved, and pointed the children and trusted you to God. You hear from the Father, "Well done, good and faithful parent." Dad, go for the gold of a child's heart that never tarnishes and is infinitely far more valuable for eternity than a big shiny bottle cap on a string. Would you bow with me, please?